Right. Well, thanks, Randy, for the invitation to participate in this symposium, and I feel honored to be lined up with the speakers that are in this session. So one of the things that I tried to do here is I'm going to give some physiographic overview of where we're sitting to provide some of that background and then give some examples of the range and variability of soils that we observe in the desert Southwest. If you're on the pedology field tour, you're going to see some of these slides again, so maybe the second time around it'll stick, right? So I put up these images that I put down here, give a good example. I'm going to use the light. Of the different kinds of landscapes, particularly in southern Arizona, that we see with uplifted mountain ranges and very shallow soils, etisols, and maybe some mollisols up in the higher elevations, versus old fans with very distinct vegetative communities, versus young fans with a distinct set of properties and vegetation communities. So to give some of this physiographic overview, this white star is us here in Phoenix. These outlines are the USGS physiographic provinces. These are all part of the Basin and Range with the Great Basin here and then the Southern Basin and Range sections here. So we're down here in part of the Southern Basin Range in the Sonoran Desert system. And I realized after I put the talk together I didn't indicate the range of deserts in the Southwest, ranging from the Mojave in eastern and southeastern California to the Sonoran Desert where we are now into the Chihuahuan Desert to our east. And my talk is going to be Arizona biased because that's where we are and that's where I'm currently live and where my research has been. And so in focusing on Arizona, we can split the state into three physiographic provinces within that basin and range. There's the basin and range zone where we're in, which is typified by these north-south trending mountains with basins filled with sediment in between. There's a transition zone with a complex set of geology and different parent materials as we transition onto the Colorado Plateau, which is being slowly uplifted over time, and still some open questions as to what is driving that the uplift of the Colorado Plateau. So most of what I'm going to present is going to focus on this basin and range zone in southern Arizona. And so this is I think that's supposed to be a north symbol. So that's not sure. Ooh. Okay. So, this is the 1 to 1 million scale geologic map of Arizona, just to highlight the diversity of parent materials. The blues here are mainly Quaternary sediment of varying age, and then we get into some complex mix of metamorphic and metasedimentary and metavolcanic rocks, and then largely dominated by old sedimentary deposits up in the Colorado Plateau. And so, Arizona during its geologic history has gone through periods of time where it was a shallow ocean receiving sediments, and that's the result. And so all of these sedimentary materials are a result of that cycling in the deep geologic past. But we've also been, the landscape is largely a result of both subduction as well as we'll touch on basin and range tectonics that kind of set off the landscape we see today. So this is going to be a little time slice going back in time. So about 50 million years ago, this is the hypothesized setting. Here's Arizona outlined on the North American plate. We have the Pacific and the Farallon plate, and then offset with a spreading ridge in between. Okay, and so the direction is that the Farallon and Pacific plate are moving under the North American plate. And there's some interesting dynamics as we go to 30 million years ago. This rise starts to interact with the North American plate, and that kicks off some volcanism, as well as there is a change in the angle of subduction. So the over time, the angle of subduction started to shallow out. So at this time period, volcanism was moving from the west to the east as that active melting zone moved further inland. And then following that, the subduction, it steepened, and the active volcanism moved back to the west. And so there's a set of tertiary and age volcanics and old calderas throughout southern Arizona. Now, about 15 million years ago, we had the spreading ridge separating the Pacific from the Farallon subducted completely. And so you had this, and if you've ever taken a field trip, and I'm going to give homage to Randy here, everyone has to put their hands together, and then we pulled it apart, right, as that subduction zone went under the continent, And so you had uplift of mountain ranges and then intervening basins that were filled with sediment. And that uplift and spreading started from the west and moved to the east. So it's where we sit now is active tectonically probably about 12 million years ago, more or less, or maybe more on the younger side, about 10 million years ago. So these uplifted mountain ranges we see here, which look rugged and diverse, are actually been sitting here eroding for about 10 million years. It's just the arid environment leads to a very rugged set of mountains. And here's the current setting where that spreading ridge also kicked off the separation of Baja California and translated into the San Andreas Fault. And so in present conditions were very tectonically quiescent here in the southwest. So the real last major episodes of tectonic uplift was about 10 million years ago. And so that resulted, again, here's an outline of this basin range of this uplifted Horst and Grabens, which sunk during that extension, which then eroded and filled these basins with sediment. And so the sediment in these basins can be thousands of feet thick, and most of this is going to be then tertiary in age, late tertiary in age, and then we find a thick, or a relatively thin cap of quaternary alluvium sitting on top of this old sediment. And so these are the majority of the soils that we see are formed in this quaternary cap. Let's see, modern climate, to give complete the physiographic setting, we are the warm desert here, as you can feel today, I think it's supposed to be 90 degrees tomorrow. I have to say Tucson is better than Phoenix. We're typically much cooler, but I'm not biased. The warm, low desert of the Sonoran, and one thing that typifies the Sonoran and makes it relatively unique is this is the distribution of rainfall, the fraction of that mean annual precipitation that comes during the winter. And as you move from the west to the east, you go from dominantly winter rainfall dominated to summer rainfall dominated in the Chihuahuan Desert. Here in the Sonoran, we're about a 50-50 split, where we get a bimodal rainfall distribution of both cool, wet, kind of relatively peaceful rains in the winter coming off the Pacific versus monsoon, what we call the monsoon, convective thunderstorm activity in the summer, which accounts for the other half of the rain. And this leads to a very unique and diverse plant assemblage. I'm going to show my bias. I think it's the most interesting of the three deserts, but again, we can talk about that. That's the modern climate, but many of the soils that we see are also a legacy of glacial-interglacial cycling. So this is from a recent paper in Nature Geoscience where they did some modeling with general circulation models of during the last glacial maximum, here's the extent of the ice sheet where we had right off the front of that, you had dry conditions as the high-pressure system sets up on the edge of that ice sheet. And as we transition into the southwest, we actually become much wetter during that period. And this is model output from CCMS4, I believe, which is a general circulation model that was run for the last glacial maximum. And this is the difference between modern temperature and that last glacial maximum temperature. And so you can see here, we are sitting anywhere from about 5 to 9 degrees cooler during those glacial periods. And we also had an increase in precipitation anywhere upwards of, say, 50 to even 75% over what we see today. So, say, the system we're sitting in now, which is currently bordering on thermic and hyperthermic, we would have been probably a warm mesic environment, maybe more of a winter rainfall-dominated system, so potentially more of a xeric soil moisture regime. So very diverse, a very different climatic setting than what we have currently. And this is also evidenced by pack rat bitten data, which indicates substantial vegetation variation during glacial periods. And this is an image I stole off the web because it's a cute little pack rat. And so these are convenient paleoclimate indicators because they forage about 100 meters around their nest, and they repopulate those nests generation after generation. And so they're bringing back plant parts from an area, a small area around that nest, and then they live in there and they urinate all over that material, which then preserves it from decomposition. And so you get these layers of material that you can come back and radiocarbon date and then identify the vegetation assemblage. And so from these kind of data, we know that this is an example of pack rat mitten data from the Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, which is pushing one of the hottest, driest environment in North America, just in the southeast or the southwest corner of the state. And you can see that coming out of the last glacial maximum, the vegetation assemblage was dominated by conifers, junipers, and some pines. Whereas coming into the modern Holocene type system, it transitioned away from that into the current desert scrub environment we have. So we know that there was large climate and vegetation changes that coincident with that glacial cycling. And this can also be tied to quaternary sediment pulses. So here's a record of temperature proxies from a number of different environments. And when we start looking and dating the quaternary age sediment deposits, we see some distinct patterns where we saw there were large sediment pulses at this glacial, so this is the glacial to interglacial transition where you had a very rapid warming and change of the climate. And so it resulted in large flushes of sediment coming out and being deposited on the landscape. And so the geomorphologists I speak with kind of, liken it as, during the glacial periods we were forming soils up in the uplands. And when we transitioned to that arid system, all of that soil essentially got stripped and then deposited into the basins. And so we have this cyclic period of deposition, which leads to a very kind of age strata of quaternary alluvium. Now, it's hard to find at times this sediment from this range because this large event tended to bury the sediment deposits from this mid-scale time range. All right, so this results in a variety of soil orders. This is the G. Sergo data, so you can see there's a lot of gaps. This is all Forest Service land that hasn't been converted to Sergo, and large portions of these are actually still unmapped. This is a large chunk of BLM land and Barry Goldwater bombing range down here. So there's a range of soils, and we cover a large number of the soil orders. We're missing, of course, gelisols, oxisols, and, we may be able to find some multisols in some spots, maybe up in some highly weathered granitic terrain up in the high elevation. But we do see histosols in small isolated environments in mountain meadows. There are fairly extensive regions of andisols that don't show up on this map in the volcanic fields in the northern portion of the state. And there's a great old experiment station report from the 30s of a guide hiking up in the White Mountains, the Mount Baldy here, which claims that there are glacial moraines with spodosols on andesitic moraine material. So that sounds like a field trip we should all go on and go look for those. One of the things that gets masked with this iridisol classification is all the diversity. So iridisol, again, is anything with subsurface diagnostic horizon in an aridic environment. And so there's a tremendous amount of soil diversity here that gets masked by this kind of iridisol at the soil order level. Okay, so the typical soil landscape arrangement, these both kind of block diagrams kind of depict the same type of feature where we have the uplifted mountain front, the basins filled with sediment, and then we have kind of generally a stair step as you move up higher towards the mountain front, you get older and older soil surfaces. Okay. And so I'm going to give time allowing, go through a number of examples from each of these types of landscapes to give some pretty pictures of what those soils look like as well as the soil forming processes. And so down here in the basin floor on this kind of stair step technique or the stair step arrangement, we have modern Holocene alluvium moving up to, late early Pleistocene, possibly late Pliocene age alluvium at the highest elevations. And this is a typical chronosequence that we observe. This is just outside of Tucson, actually following on work that Les McFadden did way back when he was working on his master's project, or his master's work at University of Arizona. Where in the modern floodplains, we have flue vents, and then over time, we get greater and greater subsurface structural development, where we have a cambic horizon, there's some carbonate accumulation that doesn't show up here, then moving to a calciargid, and finally, on the oldest surface, this is about a 2-million-year-old surface, we have this cemented petrocalcic horizon, and it doesn't show up in a very red, very clay-rich argillic horizon sitting right on top of that. And so there's a great publication by Joe McAuliffe, which was tying soil properties to vegetation assemblage, but it gave a great typical example of that, the change in the distribution of soil properties with depth over time, with the development of a well-pronounced argillic horizon, the accumulation of carbonate, and then some of the redistribution of rock fragments that goes on when you develop these clay-rich horizons. And these are data from that same chronosequence where this is the clay percent and the particle size control section where it increases exponentially with age, and then the color, the hue, it gets redder as time goes on. And there's a nice disconnect, at least we hypothesize a disconnect, and you can find this often. If you're on the field trip, we saw a great example of we had an argillic horizon with a calcic horizon in the middle. It was reactive, carbonate reactive from the surface down to the bottom of the calcic. And then when the argillic reemerged, there weren't any carbonates in that. So it indicates that argillic horizon formed first, and then the carbonates accumulated on top of that argillic horizon. So there's a, we wave our hands and say the argillics were likely forming during the glacial periods, and then the carbonates have been accumulated during these hot, dry interglacial periods. Of course, that's a gross generalization. The other unique thing about the desert Southwest is the elevation gradients. And so we have what are called sky islands. And so essentially these are, this comes from the birding community. You have these islands of forest at the tops of these mountains amongst kind of an ocean of desert. That's the metaphor. And so we have, it provides the opportunity for looking at climate gradients over a relatively short distance. So we can go from desert scrub, you know, up to mixed conifer forest over, you know, in a less than a 20-mile drive, right? And so there's a great opportunity to then to take advantage of this and look at soil processes. And this is an example outside of Tucson, where you can see from the morphology of these photos, the main change in process is, one, the profiles are getting deeper, so we're getting greater weathering and a greater extent of conversion of bedrock to soil, and we also have greater carbon accumulation. And we see this in the weathering as well. This is work from former grad student Rebecca Liebrand, looking at the degree of feldspar. This is plagioclase alteration from these two types of systems, kind of the extreme, the mixed conifer and the desert scrub. And so you can see at the mixed conifer, the plagioclase grains are completely altered to secondary phases, whereas in the desert scrub, there's very little alteration of that same type of mineral. And actually, you see what look like little clay films on the top of this. And the geochemistry suggests of these that they actually are not derived necessarily from the plagioclase, but are collecting from the solution phase. And we see concurrent with this, this is the pedogenic development index following Hardin and others, and this is mean annual precipitation over potential of evapotranspiration as a proxy for, this essentially is an increase in elevation or an increase in moisture availability. We see an increase in this the PDI values, but what's interesting is when you start looking at within an elevation zone or climate system at convergent versus divergent systems, The convergent soils show a much greater degree of development, as you'd expect, relative to the divergent soils. And that's largely driven by much greater carbon accumulation and some clay accumulation. And we can take this further, and this is a more detailed study up at the top of the Catalina Mountain. So this is in that mixed conifer forest, so one of kind of the wet end of what we'd find here in the Southwest. And when we start modeling the spatial distribution of those soil properties, we see distinct soil-landscape relationships where, as you'd expect, there's more clay and carbon in these convergent water-gathering portions of the landscape. And even though this landscape is relatively moist, it's still well-drained. And so we see greater degree of, this is sodium depletion, so as a proxy for, say, plagioclase weathering, where there's more depletion in these water-gathering zones. And this actually turns out, this is an outcropping of quartzite in an otherwise granitic landscape. And so you can see that pop up in the, so beware of tau values and make sure of the parent material that you are on. Okay, and let's see, I think there's a litho sequence. So this kind of spans the state. And again, this is in a ponderosa pine system, and it was designed to go across an acidity gradient, going from a limestone or dolostone material to basalt, granite, and then rhyolite. And, you know, we do get, this is it, you know, maybe 7,000 feet elevation, and the KCL pH values on this do get into the low fours, even pushing a high three, so that we do get acid soils and exchangeable aluminum on acidic parent materials under the right conditions in the desert. Well, these aren't quite desert, they're kind of semi-humid forest systems. So, and I put this awful table in because I didn't take time to make a figure of this. But just to show that the pH value, if you can actually read those, these are the pH values in water on the rhyolite to the limestone, so going from so moderately acidic to neutral. And then the clay percentage varies substantially, where, of course, we have more clay accumulated on the basalt surfaces. And this also comes into play when we look at the amount of organic carbon stored, as well as the amount of carbon that was consumed during the mineral weathering process. So doing some mass balance calculations, you can see that the rhyolite and the basalt have consumed the most, say, carbonic acid through their weathering processes. And mineralogically, the rhyolite and the granite are almost identical, except for the granite is coarse-grained and the rhyolite is fine-grained. And you can see the impact of that on the degree of chemical weathering as well as carbon cycling within those. Okay, and finally, there's the U again. That's supposed to be facing north. This is a sequence of, this is work we actually have in review right now. We're working with a geomorphologist at the University of Arizona. We looked at the San Francisco volcanic sequence, which is Flagstaff sits here, so just north of us by a couple hours and up in elevation. This is Mount Humphreys, which is an old stratovolcano, andesitic material. And then you have this nice range of cinder cones that range in age from several million years ago to Sunset Crater, which erupted just on the order of less than 1,000 years ago. So it provides a great opportunity to look at soil development in these systems. And so what we did is we sampled both north and south aspects across this age gradient. So we kind of have a chrono-topo sequence of sorts. And what you can see from the photos is that it gets red as they get older. What's not shown here is the clay accumulation increases with age. But there's also some distinct patterning by aspect. And what this is largely driven by is that, again, these are basaltic cinder cones. And so by looking at the mineralogy, we can readily determine, based on the quartz percentage, how much of that fraction is derived from dust. And so what we consistently see is that across the age gradient is that we see a greater fraction of the fines on the south-facing slopes being derived from dust. And there's about a threshold. There's a nice threshold in some change where it looks like you have to accumulate enough dust before you kick off enough water-holding capacity to get a lot of change and weathering started in these soil systems. That the same plays out when you convert these to a mass per area basis. And our working hypothesis is tying this age gradient back to glacial interglacial cycling and the difference in vegetation distribution during these periods. So during the modern, as we are now, the north-facing slopes have greater vegetation. They're cooler and wetter, and so you have forested systems, where the south-facing slopes tend to be more grassland with maybe more shrubby vegetation. But during the last glacial maximum, that would have been reversed. Okay, that's the last glacial maximum. It equates to about elevation moving down, or vegetation moving about 1,000 feet downwards in elevation. And so during those glacial periods and some of those long, cool transitions in the glacial periods, the south-facing slopes would have been more vegetated, and the north-facing slopes would have been cold, pushing kind of alpine-type conditions. And so what we're hypothesizing is that during those glacial periods, and this is just an image of the dust content from Iceland, not Iceland, the other pole from Antarctica, showing the fluctuation in global dust deposition with during glacial periods. These gray lines here are glacial and the white are interglacial. And so during these glacial periods, when the world was a dusty place, the vegetation would have been on the south-facing slope, and the vegetation acts as a very effective dust capture, and hence that dust gets put into the soil profile. Okay, so to wrap up, I wanted to give a flavor of the different kinds of soils and processes, which hopefully kicks off a good start to the remainder of the talks. It's a very complex geologic history with, you know, Precambrian granites and Paleozoic-aged metasedimentary and metavolcanics, and then the tectonic uplift and landscape rearrangement during basin and range spreading. And the impact of these distinct periods of sediment deposition and how that results in these chronosequences and a distinct set of soils in these basin systems. The change with climate going up in elevation with cation loss and carbon cycling and mineral weathering. And then the redistribution of material kind of following the classic topo sequence idea. And finally, the impact of parent material is particularly large in these systems that border on beans that are, you know, arid to semi-arid, where the underlying bedrock can play a larger role. It doesn't get washed out by the climate on top of it. So parent material plays a large role in the properties that we observe. And I didn't put anything on there about the cinder cones because I ran out of space. All right, so that's it. So thank you.
We have a few minutes left for some questions for Craig.
Well, I just, that last statement is having me think about in a drier environment. I might almost propose that, I mean, so that my, I would have thought the opposite, that it's so dusty, bare material should have much less effect than in a system that doesn't have as much dust.
That's a good question, and actually, dust comes in, and I'm sure the next talk will touch on that. But often on the basaltic, so if you took a granitic fan and a basaltic flow of the same age, you're likely to have more dust on that basaltic flow. It has a rougher surface. It's generally a better dust capturer, and so you get these nice aeolian horizons. Where in the granitic material, you may not have that fraction of dust in the mineral soil. And we actually see in the desert systems some of the work that Rebecca has done on bedrock. We see in the desert systems on granite that the dust fraction is maybe 10 to 12% of the fine earth fraction, but when you get into the conifer forest, it's more like 20 to 25%. And it's because you got those trees sticking up in a big dust-filled world capturing all that dust.
Any other questions?
The question was the relatively low amount of CO2 consumption in the limestone material from those. And actually, so what that mass balance took into account was the dissolution of the limestone itself. And so you get a net, it's kind of a net zero when you dissolve and then put that in solution and precipitate. The way it balances out. And the other thing that we found was that a large fraction of the material on the limestone was actually basaltic cinders from nearby volcanic eruptions. So our limestone profile was more like a limestone-influenced tephra deposit, if you qualify it that way. Okay, so the question was how did the details on the contribution of dust to soil. So the way we have done it, there are a couple of different ways to do it. You can do it geochemically based on the signature of the dust and the parent material in the soil and can mass balance those. We've also, working on the basalt, it's much easier because all you need is you can do some quantitative mineralogical analysis, and the basalt is quartz free, so any quartz in the soil has to be coming from the dust. And there's some good regional estimates of dust mineralogical composition. So, you know, the dust usually is like 30 to 35% quartz. You know, the soil is this much quartz. You can do the mixing ratio of how much of that fraction actually is from dust. And we've also tweaked or fiddled around with doing it based on particle size. With laser particle size analysis, you often see that dust, a focus of dust in that, you know, that silt, that very fine sand to silt to coarse clay distribution in that particle size distribution.
So just as a follow-up then, it sounds like a lot of that is locally derived dust. If it's in a very fine sand fraction, it's coming from, it's not from the Sahara, or from the Gobi Desert, it's local?
Yeah, so there have been some isotopic estimates looking at carbonate formation that put local dust transport about 200 kilometers or so, and this was work from Jay Quaid and one of his students, and they were looking at what the source of the carbonate in some of those petrocalcic horizons. And what they were finding is that it actually looks like it's petrocalcic horizons eroding, being uplifted as dust, and then being locally redeposited. So there's a lot of redistribution through airfall.
Time for one more. Going once. All right. Well, thank you.